Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we have a very special program. We're going to devote the entire hour to the politics and the demographics of oil. That's right, the price of oil is beginning to rise once again, raising concerns. And the question is, well, besides all the turbulence in the Middle East, what else lies behind the price of oil? With us today for this full hour are two special guests. One is Thomas Mast, who's had 40 years of experience in the petrochemical industry, and he's the author of a book, Over a Barrel. And then we have Professor David Goodstein, Professor of Physics and former Vice Provost at the California Institute of Technology. And his latest book is Out of Gas. And so today we're going to talk about oil. What are some of the forces behind oil? And I should mention that these two interviews are pre-recorded, so that some of their numbers may be a little bit out of date. But the concept, of course, are still as fresh as when these interviews took place. Also, I'd like to thank everyone who showed up for my 10-city book tour and also purchased a copy of Physics of the Future. It was because of you that the book sailed on to the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, for over a month, it was among the top 10 nonfiction books sold in the entire United States of America. And it was, of course, the number one science book in the United States. Once again, the book is called Physics of the Future, and some community and public radio stations are using the book to raise funds to make their signals strong and financially viable. So once again, the book is called Physics of the Future, about the next 100 years in medicine, technology, computers, artificial intelligence, as told to me by over 300 scientists that I've had the privilege of interviewing for Exploration, as well as BBC Television, the Discovery Channel, and the Science Channel. So once again, in this entire hour today, we're going to talk about oil. What's behind the price of oil? Are we running out of oil? What's happening with oil? So once again, let's begin with our first guest, Thomas Mast. He's had 40 years of experience in the petrochemical industry, and he's the author of a book called Over a Barrel. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in the whole question of oil and energy, and what about your background?
Well, I'm a mechanical engineer. I have a master's in mechanical engineering and also an MBA. I grew up in West Texas in the oil fields of the Permian Basin. And I have done some work for oil companies. I've roused about it and roughnecked, and I've worked for an oil tool company. But most of my career, and I am retired, was spent in manufacturing and engineering management. And I think that the kinds of thinking that we need to be doing for the future are about alternatives to oil. And those are really more mechanical engineering problems than they are petroleum engineering problems and geophysics. Then more specifically, answer your question, I realized about a year ago that the average person on the street has no understanding of this very complex issue. And I'm concerned that my children and grandchildren won't have the conveniences of cheap energy, particularly cheap transportation, that I've enjoyed. So I decided to write a short and succinct book that would allow the man on the street or the woman on the street to understand this pretty complex problem that we're facing.
Okay. Well, a lot of people are angry about the fact that gasoline prices at the pump are rising, and there seems to be no relief in sight. People are thinking twice about SUVs now. And so the question is, why? Why are gas prices so high?
Well, in answer to that question, I usually say that the high prices of crude oil and therefore gasoline these days are a symptom of the problem and not the real problem. The fundamental problem is that the worldwide supply of oil is having a hard time keeping up with the demand, and we're within 1 or 2% of having the demand catch up with the supply. Whereas we had a pumping capacity reserve of 15 or 20% 10 or 20 years ago. So there's a lot of speculation that there may be a shortage of oil caused by some interruption, a hurricane, or a terrorist activity, and this has driven the speculators to drive the price of oil up even before we have a real shortage, and then when we do have a real shortage, which could come relatively soon, well, then no telling how high the price of oil may go.
And some people point to the fact that, as you pointed out, there's more demand for oil from, for example, China and India. China and India are only going to get bigger and bigger in terms of their economies. They're going to want to repeat all the mistakes of the West, and they're going to want to have cheap oil. So what are your thoughts about China and India now joining in on this market?
Well, that definitely is one of the issues. China, just last year, accounted for 40% of the growth in oil demand for the whole world. And why shouldn't they have their shot at all the things that Europe and America have had over the last 100 years, cheap energy to provide for transportation and all the other things that make our lives so pleasant? One thing that most people haven't thought about is that in the roughly 100-year life of the automobile, airplane, and the oil industry, Europe and America, the developed parts of the world, and Japan, had to develop the technologies, the automobile and the airplane and all the other devices that use oil-based fuels. And now that development's all done, and so China and other developing countries can roll that technology out much more rapidly than America and Europe and Japan did 50 or 100 years ago.
Now, the current generation of people alive have always had oil, relatively cheap oil, and of course we like to think it's going to last forever. However, we do have something called proven oil reserves, and on one hand, they sound very comforting. However, other people say, bah, humbug, these proven oil reserves are nothing but numbers you get by shooting a dart at a dartboard. So, well, the question is, how much oil do we really have?
Well, there is some disagreement on how much we have, and there's some science involved, and there's also some art involved. And another factor is that increasingly the countries that have oil are playing their cards close to their chest and not revealing their reserves as forthrightly as they might. And again, that's their privilege. But most people feel that the world has used approximately half of the conventional oil that was there for us to use. It was created over 100 million years ago, and we used it in roughly 100 years. My mother died recently, and she was 91 years old, and during a single lifetime, we developed the automobiles and the airplanes and the oil industry and used up about half of the oil, conventional oil, that the world has. And now we have four times as many people in the world and almost infinitely more cars and planes, and we're going to go through the second half of that oil fairly quickly. So you can argue about whether the remaining reserves are 1 trillion barrels, as some people say, or whether they're 1.5 trillion barrels. But I don't think anybody would argue that the supply of oil is not finite, and sooner or later is going to cause a shortage situation around the world.
Now, explain to us, what is Hubbert's Peak? Because that, of course, is the center of a lot of controversy right now.
Well, a man named Dr. M. King Hubbert worked for Shell in a research position. He was a geophysicist, and he predicted in the late 50s, I believe, that the production of oil in the United States would peak and begin to decline about 1970, and sure enough, that's exactly what it did. And so then he went on to predict the peak for the world oil production. And he predicted that, I believe, initially in the 90s, and that time has come and gone. And other people have subsequently used his same techniques to predict the peak of worldwide oil production. And they their estimates run all the way from 2000 to 2020, with many of them grouped around the 2005 to 2010 time period. There are some international organizations and the U.S. Department of Energy who don't feel the worldwide peak of oil is going to come that soon. So there is some disagreement. But my feeling is that it's going to come soon relative to the time that it takes decide on the alternatives to oil and then to convert them into massive industries. Oil provides 38% of the world's energy. It's by far the number one source of energy in the world. And for transportation here in this country, oil-based fuels provide 97% of our transportation fuels. And so it's not a simple task to phase in alternatives to oil once we know what they are, and we don't even know what they are very well. So we do have a challenge ahead of us.
Now, you mentioned that the nations that have most of the oil reserves play it very close to the chest. And isn't it true that there's a lot of politics involved? Because, of course, your estimates of proven oil reserves will affect whether or not investors invest money in your country. And isn't it true, therefore, as some people have charged, that these so-called proven oil reserves are nothing but made-up numbers fabricated by nations interested in protecting their economy and their level of investment?
Well, that's true. And the one thing that happened not so very many years ago was that OPEC decided that among the OPEC nations, the fraction each country got of the allowable production was based on their reserves. And once they made that decision, all of the OPEC nations instantly or within a year greatly increased the reserves that they had announced having and had nothing to back it up. They just had an increase in reserves, which to my recollection was around 50%. So many people feel those increases were made out of whole cloth.
And also, some people say that we will always find new deposits of oil. But isn't it true that the rate at which we defined new deposits of oil has been going down? So even if we do continue to find new deposits of oil, they're not going to be like they were in the past. We would have to discover a whole Middle East in the future in order just to maintain the status quo.
Well, that's right. All the fields that we're pumping out of now are declining. When people mention that we found oil in the past and we'll use new technologies to find more oil, I usually point to a curve that's in my book, and it shows the new oil discoveries worldwide by decade for the last 60 or 70 years. And the worldwide discoveries of new oil fields peaked in the 1950s and 1960s. And by the decade of the 1990s, worldwide discoveries of new oil fields were down to less than 25% of what they were in the late 1950s. And so one has to be very optimistic to think we're going to develop technology for finding new oil fields that's so vastly superior to the excellent technology we've had in the last two or three decades that we can turn that curve around and start finding more oil than we did even 50 years ago.
Well, some people are saying that we'll drill in Alaska, in the wildlife refuge there, and that'll help us prevent an oil crisis in this country. But isn't it true that even if we do pump out a lot of oil from there, it's just a drop in the bucket compared to what it would really require just to maintain the status quo indefinitely?
Absolutely. The NWAR field that's discussed in Alaska is a big field and would make some difference, perhaps supplying 7% or so of the U.S. Needs, even though it won't come online for 5 or 10 years once the decision is made to start drilling there. But the United States only has 2 to 3% of the world's oil reserves. And so having a national policy to see how fast we can pump those remaining 2 or 3% out of the ground and use them up doesn't seem to be a good long-range strategy. We need to come up with some alternatives to oil so that we can save or husband the oil that we have left for petrochemical industries and lubricants and some things that that are more difficult to replace than oil for fuels.
Okay, well, we mentioned the fact that even if we discover an entire new Middle East, another Saudi Arabia out there, which is highly unlikely, that would only push back the date, of when we reach Hubbard's Peak just by a little bit, right? So we still have to face the inevitable.
It's inevitable that oil production worldwide will begin to decline sometime and probably soon. And incidentally, natural gas and coal are also hydrocarbons, which were created hundreds of millions of years ago. And natural gas probably will begin a worldwide decline not too awfully much later, perhaps a decade or two after oil. We do have a 200 or 300 year supply of coal around the world, but as you know, it's the dirtiest of the hydrocarbon fuels. It puts out about 1.8 times as much carbon dioxide per unit of energy as natural gas.
Now let's talk about the future and consequences. If the price of oil skyrockets, that's going to put a real crimp on people who depend on the automobile, and that could in turn dampen the economy. So give us an indication of what might happen in the future if nothing is done.
Well, prices of fuels no doubt will escalate, and of course that's inflationary. It causes the not only your personal transportation costs to go up, but the cost of trucking groceries and almost everything else you buy. And so it will be inflationary in the beginning. Whatever happens is going to happen worldwide. So if it makes businesses less efficient and less attractive, then after an inflationary period, we may have a recession or depression effect, not only in this country, but perhaps around the world.
So let's translate that in terms of things that people can understand. If the price of oil rises dramatically in the next several years, that means the price of goods and services begin to skyrocket. It means that people are not going to be able to buy the things they're accustomed to buying. They're not going to be able to commute to the suburbs like they used to. A huge chunk of their wallet is going to be taken out, essentially, right? And so you're talking about basically sending the economy into a tailspin, right?
Well, that's a definite possibility, and that's why the stakes are so high, and that's why we need to be betting on something other than just oil. But in addition to the things that you mentioned, there are international implications. You know, if we were to move into a true shortage of oil, then there's going to be increased contention among countries for the remaining supplies. And 63% of those supplies are in the Middle East. And as China gets larger and more powerful, well, we may have to argue with China about who gets what share of oil. And then in addition to that, we're already sending out of this country about $230 billion a year just to purchase oil. It's 35 or 40% of our balance of trade problems. And if the price of oil were to double or quadruple, well, you can see what would happen to our balance of trade and the effects that may have on the value of the dollar.
So you're saying that there could be international tensions, right, especially because the oil reserves are in the Middle East, which is a very volatile region, and it makes us even more dependent upon the politics of a very volatile region, right?
That's absolutely right. And if we don't develop some alternatives to oil and or conserve what we got, use less of it, I think it's inevitable that there'll be increased international tensions.
And very soon, you're saying that we could be hitting Hubbert's Peak either now or perhaps 2005, but definitely perhaps in this decade, right? So we're talking about not an emergency that's going to happen 30 years from now, but something that could happen very soon.
That's a definite possibility. And to me, it seems foolish to gamble. So let's say that the world didn't hit Hubbert's Peak until 2020, but let's say we were to get serious this year or next year and have a moon landing kind of a program to reduce our dependence on oil, that would strengthen the dollar and reduce our exposure to the Middle East and have some positive effects on our country, even if oil didn't peak for another 15 years. So it seems to me like we've got very little to lose by assuming that oil is going to become short in 2 or 3 years, and if it doesn't, if it takes 10 or 15, I don't see that we've lost anything by reducing our dependence on oil.
Okay, well, now let's bite the bullet and ask the question, what will it take to gradually have a program to phase in other kinds of technologies? And, of course, nothing is being done at the present time by the current administration. So let's take these one at a time. First of all, you mentioned coal. We have lots of coal, but what about the politics of coal?
Well, coal is a nasty substance to burn environmentally. It puts out a number of nasty pollutants, and then it puts out huge amounts of carbon dioxide, which contribute to global warming. And there's not much way around that. There's been some talk about sequestering the carbon dioxide underground, but I think everyone agrees that that would be very expensive, and nobody's made any really serious moves to head in that direction. So, and again, coal is also a hydrocarbon, which will become short in 200 or 300 years, even if we don't use it aggressively. And so that may not affect you and me, but it will affect our descendants, and we need to come up with something other than these hydrocarbons to form the base of our energy economy.
And doesn't coal also release mercury in the air and also acid rain?
Yes, those are some of the pollutants that I mentioned earlier.
Okay, now let's talk about natural gas. You mentioned that there's also a Hubbert's Peak for natural gas as well, and it also creates carbon dioxide. But what are your thoughts about natural gas?
Well, natural gas is a relatively clean fuel to burn compared to both oil and coal, but it still does create carbon dioxide. We've been importing natural gas from Mexico and Canada, but we've about reached the point where in North America we don't have enough natural gas, so we're beginning to import liquefied natural gas, LNG. Unfortunately, importing gas from overseas, natural gas, is more difficult than importing oil, because oil in its natural state is a liquid and natural gas is a gas, and so it has to be liquefied before it can be shipped over here, and that's an expensive, energy inefficient process and also a very dangerous one. And so again, we have these social issues. We have technological issues and we have social issues, and the social issue of natural gas is the same as the social issue of refineries. Everybody wants the benefits of cheap energy, but nobody wants a refinery or a liquefied natural gas port anywhere near where they live.
And what about conservation? Some environmentalists say that we waste an enormous amount of energy in this country, and even modest attempts to increase fuel efficiency would have tremendous dividends. But what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are absolutely that we should be conserving. Now, some people mention nothing but conserving, and even if we were only burning half of the oil that we're burning, we still, sooner or later, would run into a shortage situation. So what conservation of oil does, and I'll just concentrate on oil for the moment, does is give us more time to develop these alternatives, be they nuclear, hydrogen, batteries, or whatever. And we do need that time because there's some pretty difficult technical and social problems that have to be solved. And we have the technologies to conserve. Europeans drive cars that get about twice the gas mileage ours do because they've had their gasoline prices at about triple our level for decades. And so the technologies to drive, to build and drive a much more efficient personal transportation vehicles already exist. We don't have to wait for the research and development to be done there. And of course, the hybrids are existing technology, and they roughly double the fuel mileage that a car will get.
And isn't it true that simply by increasing fuel efficiency in cars, we could vastly reduce the consumption of oil in this country by simply increasing, mandating an increase in fuel efficiency?
Absolutely right. And the administration just hasn't been able to convince itself that it should do that. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because I don't believe the lawmakers are going to pass these difficult pieces of legislation unless they feel they have more backing from the people than they have. So people need to understand the whole oil situation so that they're willing for their lawmakers to pass some medium to long range legislation that will cost some conservation, but it might be a little bit painful to people's pocketbooks or cause them to have to get rid of their SUV and drive a car they don't like quite as well.
And what about wind power? Wind power in Europe is enjoying a tremendous boom right now. What about wind power, which seems to be underutilized, especially in the Midwest?
Well, wind power is definitely an example of something we should be pushing harder than we are. We've had some incentives from the federal level for wind power, but as I understand it, they're off again, on again, and so there's no consistency, and this has caused it to be a little bit difficult for companies to make the kinds of long-term investments that are needed.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Our special guest was Thomas Mast, who has had 40 years of experience in the petrochemical industry, and he's the author of the book, Over a Barrel. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on the Vice Provost of Caltech, Dr. David Goodstein, also Professor of Physics, and he's the author of the book, Out of Gas. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Welcome back to Exploration. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, and we're talking about the politics and the demographics of oil in this hour. Our first special guest was Thomas Mast, author of the book Over a Barrel, who's had 40 years of experience in the oil industry. And in this section of Exploration, we're going to bring on a professor of physics, Dr. David Goodstein, former vice provost at Caltech, and author of the book Out of Gas. Also, let me say once again, thank you so much for those people who attended my 10-city book tour. My new book is called Physics of the Future. And in fact, for over a month, because of you, the listener to Exploration, the book was among the top 10 books, the top 10 nonfiction books sold in the entire United States of America. The book was a New York Times bestseller. So thank you so much for attending the 10-City Book Tour and also purchasing a copy of my book, Physics of the Future. And once again, various public and community radio stations will be using my book as a premium to raise funds to keep their signal alive and well. And so once again, today on our Exploration, we're going to devote the entire hour to the politics of oil. What's behind the recent increases in oil? And we pre-recorded two interviews, one with Thomas Mast, which we aired in the first part of Exploration. And in the second part of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. David Goodstein, who is a professor of physics and author of the book Out of Gas. So we'll be talking about some of the larger forces involved with the rising price of oil, besides, of course, the current turmoil in the Middle East. So again, the entire hour is about oil. Well, once again, let's begin. Once again, our special guest is Dr. David Goodstein, author of the book, Out of Gas. Okay, well, now let's get into the heart of your book, because you use a methodology that is not commonly known by most people, and that's Hubbert's Peak. So could you slowly walk through the methodology by which you arrive at some rather stunning conclusions?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about the history of it first. In the 1950s, the United States was the world's leading producer of oil. Much of our military and industrial might depended on our giant oil industry, and most people in the business expected that to go on forever. But there was one very clever geophysicist who worked for Shell Oil in Houston. His name was Marion King Hubbert, and he predicted at the time that U.S. oil production, that is the rate at which we could extract oil from the ground in the lower 48 United States, would peak around 1970 and decline forever after that. He was virtually hooted out of his profession at the time, but when 1970 came along, he turned out to be quite precisely right. And that's what's called Hubbert's Peak. That was Hubbert's Peak for the lower 48 United States. We peaked in 1970, and we have been declining rapidly ever since in output of oil from below the soil of the United States.
Yes,
go ahead. Sorry.
And I understand from your book that Hubbert's Peak not only works for oil, but for other valuable minerals as well.
The basic idea is a very simple one. For any mineral resource, the rate at which the supply of it, the rate at which you can extract it from the ground, starts out at zero, rises up to some maximum, after which you're depleting your resource faster than you can find new sources of it, and the supply starts to decline. So the history of the supply of any natural resource is a bell-shaped curve. It reaches a maximum, and that maximum is never attained again. It just falls forever after that. And that's what Hubbert's Peak is all about.
And I understand that you can apply it to other minerals and other resources as well.
The same thing happened to copper in northern Michigan, to coal in Pennsylvania, to coal in England, and any mineral resource. Now, it doesn't have to be a perfect bell-shaped curve, of course. These things are always very noisy. But crudely speaking, it rises from zero to maximum and then declines again. And, of course, exactly that happened to oil in the lower 48. By now we know that that's precisely what happened.
And also, tell us what happens when you reach 50% of the known reserves.
Right. The maximum occurs roughly when you've used up half that nature supplied for you, because roughly it's a symmetric bell-shaped curve. On the way up, you use up half of it, you reach the maximum, and then half is left, but the rate at which you can pull it out of the ground is declining, even though the need for it in the case of oil will still be increasing.
Okay, now let's assume that he's correct with regards to the world resources. When might we begin to see disruptions?
Well, nobody can really answer that question, although many people have tried, because the evidence on which the answer has to be based, the numbers, are very soft numbers. They're not very well understood. They're not very well known. They depend on so-called proved reserves of oil and other things like that are not proved at all, that are largely inventions, and really can't be depended on. There are some reasons to believe that it may already have begun. There are others who think it won't happen until sometime later in this decade. It may not happen until sometime in the next decade. The difference between those predictions are very important to us who are living now and would like to enjoy life for a few more years, but really have no importance at all in the scale of human history. It's going to happen. It's going to happen relatively soon by human historical standards. We or our children or maybe even our grandchildren are in for some very bad times.
And by that, you mean on the scale of 1, 2, 3 decades or 4, 5, 6, 7 decades?
No, I don't mean 4, 5, 6, 7 decades. I mean on the scale of 1 to 2 decades.
1 to 2 decades. So many of the people listening to this program could see their life disrupted as we see the fulfilling
Hubbard speak. That's precisely the point, yes.
Okay. Well, now let me play devil's advocate. Because, of course, if you talk to the oil industry and the U.S. Geological Survey, they say something different. Well, first of all, they say, we're never going to really run out of oil because we'll simply find more oil. So what are your thoughts about whether or not we can simply find new oil?
Well, the USGS did an exhaustive survey of world oil supplies. The survey went from 1995 to about 2000. And it's been published. You can get it over the web. They came to the conclusion, this is done by a combination of geologists who know something about geology and statisticians who know something about statistics but know nothing about geology. And it's the statisticians, apparently, who came up with the final conclusions. And the final conclusions say that with 90%, I've forgotten whether it's 90 or 95% certainty, there were at least 2 trillion barrels of oil when we started drilling. We have, just for reference, we've used up about 1 trillion barrels of oil. So if there were 2 trillion barrels of oil, we are now at the halfway point, okay? But they say with 50% probability, there may have been as much as 2.7 trillion, and with lower probability correspondingly, there may have been even more. Now, many experts are more than a little skeptical of those assumptions, which are based not on how much oil we know to be, but on predictions of how much will be discovered in the future. You must understand that the Hubbard's Peak for worldwide oil discovery, not production, but discovery, those are 2 different bell-shaped curves. You have a bell-shaped curve for discovery that reaches a maximum and declines forever, and then later, decades later, you have a bell-shaped curve for production, which reaches a maximum and declines forever. The one for the peak for discovery occurred around 1960, more than 40 years ago. Oil discovery has been declining ever since. Nevertheless, for reasons that are unclear to the outside world, the USGS predicted a high rate of discovery for another 30 years, and on that basis said that there's a 50% chance that there'll be at least 2.7 billion a trillion barrels of oil in the ground. The difference between the 2 trillion number, which is what most people who expect Hubbard's Peak very soon are using, and the 2.7 trillion that the USGS estimated, that's all the oil in the Middle East. In other words, they're predicting that we discover the Middle East all over again. The fact is that oil geologists have gone to the ends of the earth looking for oil. There are only a few places on earth that have not been fully explored. One of them is the South China Sea, where there are overlapping claims from 7 different countries, and so nobody wants to drill there. It's considered promising but not spectacular as a geological region by geologists. Second is Central Siberia, which has enormous access problems. And a third is the deep oceans, which are extremely problematic for a variety of reasons. And some say Antarctica as well, or Arctica. Otherwise, there are no possibilities. And so the probability, the likelihood that we're going to discover another 700 billion barrels of oil somewhere seem extremely remote.
Okay, to play devil's advocate again, some people bring out a certain ratio where they claim that if you take a look at how long it will take to exhaust certain reserves, we're talking about many, many, many decades before we fully exhaust certain reserves of oil. What are your thoughts?
Well, this is called the RP ratio in the industry, the reserves to production ratio, which means you take what are called approved reserves, you divide it by the amount that we used last year, and you get a number of years that we can go on using oil at the same rate without any problem. That the RP ratio today, depending on whose numbers you believe, whether you believe, let's say, BP, which does its own estimates, the large oil company that does its own estimates, or the USGS, is somewhere between 40 and 100 years. But that number is absolutely meaningless. The proved reserves are fictitious numbers. For example, the proved reserves of the OPEC countries took a sudden jump of between 300 and 400 billion barrels, about 40% of all the oil that we know to exist on Earth, sometime in the 1980s. And there were no significant discoveries during that period. That is to say, politicians discovered 400 billion barrels of oil without drilling a hole in the ground. And the reason is because this is just a game that the oil people play. The so-called proved reserves have very little to do with what's going on in real oil fields. They're numbers that are manipulated for economic and political reasons by either oil companies or oil-developing or oil-producing countries. We recently saw that Royal Dutch Shell had to reduce its proved reserves and correspondingly the price of its stock shares because an outside auditor said, no, you've been lying. Of course, nobody applies that kind of logic and scrutiny to the Middle Eastern countries, for example, who claim most of the world's oil supply. So those numbers are really pretty meaningless. And besides, we just don't go on using oil at a constant rate. The rate at which we use oil historically has risen for more than a century, will rise, continue to rise, as long as the oil is available, particularly since more than a billion Chinese people are just beginning to learn how to drive. The world population is increasing and so on. So, no, the RP ratio is not very useful.
And the United States consumes about 25% of the world's resources and energy.
Yes, about 5% of the world's population.
That's right. And what happens when the Chinese and other developing countries want the American lifestyle?
Well, I think that's virtually a rhetorical question. It's obvious what will happen. What will happen is that demand for oil will just zoom way, way up.
Okay, now let me again play devil's advocate. Other people say that capitalism will correct all the problems. As the price of oil rises, there's more incentive to A, explore for more oil, and B, look for alternatives. What are your thoughts?
Well, we've already discussed exploring for oil. I think exploring for oil is will not produce very interesting results. We have pretty much discovered most of the oil that there is to discover. The other point of view, the extreme example of the other point of view is that all fossil fuels are fungible. In other words, you can turn coal into oil, which chemically is true. One can turn coal into oil, and there's an enormous amount of chemical energy stored in the ground in the form of coal. So you run out of oil, you just use something else. And that's where the laws of economics come in. Once the oils, like crude oil, the kind of conventional oil that we've been using up to now, starts to become expensive enough, then other sources of hydrocarbons become economically competitive. And that's already happening. For example, oil sands in Alberta are being mined now at a profit. Of course, these are solid deposits. They don't gush out of the ground. You have to mine them, strip mine them, and extract the oil from the ore. And so they're not going to flood the market anytime soon. They come on very slowly. But still, they're being mined at a profit. And there are many methods, a long list of other hydrocarbons that can be turned into fuels at a price. So what we're talking about is not the end of the availability of fuels. We're talking about the end of the availability of cheap fuel. But you have to understand that our civilization has evolved because of the has evolved into the form that it has because of the availability of cheap fuel, not just the availability of fuel. Another point that's extremely important to understand is that if we go on burning fossil fuels with complete abandon, we risk doing irreversible damage to the climate of our planet. It just happens to be the only planet we have.
Now, some people say that we have enough coal to last several hundred years in the United States.
Or thousands of years even.
Right.
Yes, but
you're saying, yeah, go on.
That's a foolish estimate. The estimates of how much coal we have range from hundreds to thousands of years. And the very fact that the estimates range over a factor of 10 tells you that nobody has any idea. These are just wild guesses. But even these wild guesses are dependable compared to at the present rate of use, which is the tagline of why we have that many years to go. If you try to substitute coal for oil, the first thing you have to know is that we use twice as much energy now from oil as we do from coal. So just in order to mine enough coal to replace the oil, you'd have to mine much more coal. But the conversion process is extremely inefficient. So you have to mine not three times as much coal, but maybe 6 or 7 or 8 times as much coal. Then the world population is increasing. The Chinese want to learn how to drive, or to put it more cogently, the poorer nations of the world would like to live more like us, which means use more energy, and so on. So the rate at which fuels are going to be used is going to increase extremely rapidly. The alternative to that is war and famine and almost unimaginable chaos. So the numbers that say that there's enough coal to last for hundreds to thousands of years at the present rate of use has to be divided by at least the factor of 10, and maybe even more, to reflect the fact that the current rate of use is not going to last very long if we try to substitute coal for oil. So the bottom line is that if we just burn up all the fossil fuels we can in order to keep our civilization going, we will start running out of all fossil fuels, coal included, probably by the end of this century.
And what about natural gas?
Natural gas is an extremely good fuel because it's cleaner than either coal or oil as far as the greenhouse effect, the climate of the planet is concerned. But the Hubbert's peak for natural gas is not far behind Hubbert's peak for oil, maybe 10 years at most.
Now, some people, when they say that we have enough oil to last 60, 100 years, don't they assume that we're going to be using all of the oil, not reaching the halfway point, but
sure,
essentially using all the oil at the same price?
That's right. They're using what we've called before the RP ratio. They say there's a trillion barrels of oil. Let's suppose we started with 2 trillion barrels of oil. That's a number that some people at least accept, okay? And we've used nearly a trillion, maybe 800 billion barrels. So to people who believe in that figure, they say, all right, there's a trillion barrels of oil in proved reserves. We know where it is. All we have to do is poke a drill into the ground. The oil will come out. And since we use about 25 billion barrels a year, that gives us a 40-year supply. No problem at all. We can go tranquilly ahead for 40 years. But that's just not the way it works. We don't use it at the same rate. And we can't extract it at the same rate. The rate at which we extract it will start to decline when we reach that maximum. There'll still be plenty of oil in the ground. That trillion barrels of oil will still be there, but the rate at which we can extract it from the ground will be declining at the same time that demand for it, for all the reasons we've already discussed, will be increasing.
Okay, let's take a look at some other alternatives. Other people say, as a long shot, let's take a look far in the future, fusion power. They say that the sun is a fusion reactor, therefore it is, in principle, possible to build a fusion reactor, but what about the possibility of putting a piece of sun on the Earth?
Well, that's quite correct, and I know of at least 5 or 6 different technical scientific schemes for accomplishing that, and people have been working on it for the past 50 years. Unfortunately, success in that field has been 25 years away for 50 years, and it's still 25 years away today, and so we don't know whether the technical problems that prevent us from using that source of energy will ever be solved, but if they are solved, it would solve the problem definitively because the fuel for that kind of power would probably never be exhausted.
And the fuel for fusion power comes from seawater, right?
Well, one component of it does. The deuterium is one of the components that would be needed for the first kind, the easiest kind of fusion. And there's an almost endless supply of that in the sea. The other fuel is lithium. And lithium is a light element that's found in many common minerals, but I don't think we have any estimate at all of how much there is available on Earth.
And is it also true that break-even, that is, getting more energy out than you put in, is very elusive for fusion reactors, so they're not very economical at the present time?
Well, that's the holy grail. But we have been able to create fusion energy in reactors on the Earth. We just haven't been able to create them fast enough to catch up with the amount of energy it takes to make them happen. So the best we've done up to now is about 50%. That is to say, we get about half the energy out that we put in. If you hit break-even, then you could start thinking about ways of making use of the excess as a power source. But break-even is still decades away.
And what about hydrogen power? Hydrogen fuel cells have been getting a lot of news because they don't create carbon-based waste. They just create water as waste. But what are your thoughts about hydrogen?
Well, they create only water as waste at the point at which they're used, either by in a hydrogen fuel cell or simply by burning it as a fuel. But hydrogen is not a natural resource. Hydrogen is just a means of storing and transporting energy. You have to use energy to make hydrogen. And today, all hydrogen that's made today is made out of fossil fuels. there are basically two ways of making hydrogen out of fossil fuels. One of them is to make hydrogen out of methane. That's a fairly efficient process, but you may as well burn the methane. There's very little point in unless you really need the hydrogen in the form of hydrogen for some reason, there are reasons why people need it. It doesn't really help much to use up methane, which is a fuel, in order to make hydrogen, which is a different fuel, and has some loss of efficiency. The other possibility is to use electrical power, which is generally generated by burning fossil fuels, coal-fired power plants, for example, and electrolyzing water. The economics of that is that it takes the equivalent of 6 gallons of gasoline to make enough hydrogen to replace 1 gallon of gasoline. Now, very far in the future, when we have limitless power from nuclear fusion, if we have to solve that problem, or limitless power from huge solar arrays, if we have managed to accomplish that, then you'll be making hydrogen from renewable sources, and hydrogen may become the staple for transport. You'll never have nuclear or solar transport, that's cars or that run on nuclear energy or solar energy. You'll have to use the nuclear and solar energy to make something that you can use for transportation, and that might very well be hydrogen sometime in the future. As a solution right now, the Governor Schwarzenegger's hydrogen highway, President Bush's hydrogen car, those are not very convincing.
So in other words, hydrogen and batteries do not create energy. They simply transport energy, right?
You take energy in the form that we make it, either from fossil fuels or hydroelectric power or whatever source of energy we use, and use that to make either charged batteries or hydrogen. They both have the same effect.
Okay, and to elaborate on a point you just made, nuclear energy is not used for cars. We don't have atomic cars, and perhaps, hopefully, we will never have atomic cars. But nuclear energy is used to produce electricity, not for transportation, right? Could you elaborate?
Well, we do use nuclear fission rather than nuclear fusion. It's a different kind of nuclear reaction. That is a well-developed technology. There are hundreds of nuclear power plants in the world. Some countries like France generate most of its electricity from nuclear power, much less 20% or so in the United States, zero in Italy, in which nuclear power has been outlawed. But when the oil starts to run out, the opposition to nuclear power is likely to soften. But nuclear power is not the magic bullet that will solve all of our problems. Just to give you a benchmark, the rate at which we're burning fossil fuel today, all fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, is 10 terawatts, 10 trillion watts. That's the burn rate. In order to create the nuclear sources of energy equivalent to what we're burning in fossil fuel today, the largest nuclear fission plant that would be practical is about a gigawatt, which is a billion watts. 10 trillion watts is 10,000 times that much. So you'd have to build 10,000 brand new power plants of the largest that you can possibly build in order to replace the fossil fuel that we burn today. That would be one a day opening somewhere in the world for 30 years. It's not impossible, but it's a staggering number. And if you did that and burned up the nuclear fuel at that rate, the known reserves of uranium, if we use the uranium the way we use it today, which means to use only the rare isotope 35, the known reserves of uranium at that burn rate would last for only 10 to 20 years.
And plus you have the waste problem.
And you have the waste problem and all the other problems that are attended on nuclear energy, yes.
Okay. Now let's talk about, before we get into solar, let's talk about hybrids. Let's talk about conservation. First of all, hybrids. Of course, that is not going to be a cure-all. However, won't that help to slow down the consumption of gas?
It sure will. And in fact, we can conserve energy in many other ways. I drive a hybrid. I've been driving a hybrid since it first came out because I've been teaching my students for 30 years that that's the only sensible way to build a car. So, yes, hybrids will help. Other conservation methods will help. But they will only slow down the process. They won't turn it around.
However, fuel efficiency, won't that make a dent in the rate of consumption? Because the United States consumes such a fabulous amount of energy.
Yes, it will. And the fact is that worldwide, we've been using fossil fuel energy faster than we've been discovering it for the past 20 years. That is, as the demand curve or supply curve rises and the discovery curve falls, they crossed around 1980. So it's almost 25 years now that we've been using up oil faster than we've been finding it. We could slow that down by turning to hybrids and various other means of conserving energy, and that would certainly help. It would put the really critical problem further off into the future, and that would be good for all of us. And so, yes, conservation is one contribution, and it's not a negligible one. You have to remember there is no simple solution to this problem. It's not that the problem is insoluble, but we have to pursue every possible path, and conservation is one important.
Now let's take a look at solar. Some of the critics say that solar is not yet ready for prime time. Its proponents say that we're making leaps and strides in terms of efficiency. But what are your thoughts about solar power?
Well, once again, to put that into perspective, to replace the fossil fuel that we're burning now, those 10 terawatts I spoke about before, with the most common tech and usable technology that we have at the present, which is 10% efficient silicon solar cells, you would have to cover 220,000 square kilometers of land to generate that much power. 220,000 square kilometers is roughly half the state of California, just to give you the order of magnitude. That much land is probably available distributed around the world. That's not the big problem. The big problem is that all the photovoltaics that have been made up to now, all the silicon cells that have been made up to now, probably wouldn't cover more than 10 square kilometers. So the challenge of building the solar power plants that you're talking about big enough to make a real dent in the world's energy problems is simply a staggering problem.
And that concludes the interview with Dr. David Goodstein. Let me also say that if you take a look at the future, even though solar is perhaps twice as expensive as fossil fuel technology, prices are going to go down, and in 10 years' time, there could be a totally new political and economic landscape. So the time for solar may be in the future, maybe 10 years plus into the future. And beyond that, who knows, fusion power becomes a possibility on a 20-year horizon. So in other words, there's no one single white knight. However, conservation, renewable technologies, and eventually fusion power may give us an energy mix that'll take us well into the 21st century. But again, for more information, get a copy of my latest book, Physics of the Future, which talks about energy into the coming century. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first special guest was Thomas Mast, author of the book Over a Barrel. And the second special guest was Professor David Goodstein of Caltech, and his book was called Out of Gas. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you may want to pick up a copy of my latest book, a New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Future, about the next 100 years in technology. What about medicine, space travel, computers, our daily life? How will we commute? All these questions are addressed in my latest book, Physics of the Future. Good day.